Systems has provided a grant in support of this program. Grey Wolf Computer Systems offers custom computer systems and personalized service for repairs, upgrades, and networks in the East Cliff Village Shopping Center in Santa Cruz. It is Friday, August 13, 2004, 10:04 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. My name's Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today on Geek Speak, we are talking with author Preston Gralla about Windows XP and the newly released Service Pack 2. During the second half of the show, I welcome you to join our conversation. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can go to geekspeak.org, click on The Geeks, then click on Send a Message. That'll get to our inbox, and we'll answer it on air. I'll give out that contact information again when I invite you to participate in about a half an hour. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. My name's Lyle Troxell. And in the air room with me are geeks. Sean Cleveland, Technical Marketing Communications Manager for Transmeta. John Tracy, owner and operator of FeltonGames.com. And Miles Elam, programmer and student of American Literature. Geeks, welcome to Geek Speak.
Good morning.
Good morning.
It's so nice to have you guys here every week. Now, we're going to be talking today about how Microsoft finally released Windows XP Service Pack 2, which addresses some major security issues, some wireless improvements, and much more. Luckily, we have Preston Gralla, is a freelance journalist and author of Windows XP Hacks by O'Reilly, to join us today. Preston, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Thanks for having me.
Preston, we got your book in front of us. Great choices and great suggestions and ideas about hacking your Windows. And basically, the hacks version of machines from books from O'Reilly, excuse me, is all about finding tips and tricks to make things run faster and better for you. And your hacks book has, I guess, 100 of them for Windows XP. And I thought we'd just start out right away with an idea.
Well, let's talk about hacks. Such an odd name for a book.
Well, we have talked about it on Geek Speak before. It's
true,
Sean. Yeah, basically the idea is high-end computer users do clever things with their machines to make things, or software, to make things run faster, to do things in an interesting way, and we call those hacks. So, would you agree with that, Preston?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the idea of these books, of this series, was that, you know, originally the word hacker was not a derogatory term at all. What it meant is basically someone who loved hardware, wanted to get a better understanding of how to use it, and even more than how to use it, how to kind of push it beyond limits, push it in ways that maybe the original makers of the hardware never even envisioned. So it's really an attempt, the whole series, to get the word hackers and hacking back to the good guys rather than the bad guys.
Right.
And that's what this book aims to do for XP, show you all kinds of cool things you could do you never thought of doing, things like you want to change your boot screen, you know, maybe you didn't think you can do it. Actually, this book shows you ways, for example, how you can change your boot screen, you want to speed up using starting Windows, which can be an interminable experience, but this will make it faster. So exactly, those are the kind of things that I talk about in the book.
And not just starting Windows, shutting them down.
Yes.
Because I was wondering, why is my computer taking so long to shut down? And so I looked up the hack, and it worked. It figured it out.
What's the hack for shutting down a computer faster?
Well, go ahead.
Preston?
Well, there's a whole bunch of reasons why. I'm going to have to thumb through the book now to find it, but there's a whole bunch of reasons why your computer might be closing slowly. A lot of the reason has to do with how many services and how many applications you're running, often without knowing it. You might be running these things, having no idea you're running them. Let me give an example.
What I was doing, I found out with my machine, I was clearing the page file.
Right.
And so when I was shutting down, you have all this data in your page file that's being cached, and the computer is clearing that. It's a large file, and that's the reason why it took more than a few, it didn't quickly shut down.
Right. Now, that's an interesting one, because that's a little bit of a controversial technique. There are those among us who are very paranoid, who thinks you should clear the paging file every time you close down, because that paging file, it uses, when you are using it, all kinds of stuff can be put in there that you have used during your computing session. And so there are some people who think, well, maybe some way somebody nefariously can get in there and view it. It's pretty tough to do it. It's unlikely you're going to have anything personal in there. And so my recommendation, you hit it right on the head, if you want to shut down faster, that's one thing to do. Don't slow it. Don't clear it.
How do you – okay, first, paging file is – what is a paging file?
Basically, it's a file that gets written to RAM, written to disk. So what happens is as you're using Windows, all the information that you use actually is not going to fit in RAM in once. And so what you need to do is you need to use a paging file that gets written out to your hard disk and then read back into RAM. It's basically a way to speed up running XP and essentially to trick XP into thinking it has more memory than it really has.
Okay, I get that. So the idea is that instead of when the machine shuts down and erasing that file, you just leave it there.
That's right, just leave it there.
How do you do that?
I'm going to have to look at my book now. There's a registry key, if I remember rightly, that you have
You have to open up your reg editor.
So use reg editor and do it that way. And, that brings up another point. In this book, I talk a lot about using the registry, and I've talked to a lot of people who are a little bit frightened of the registry. It's, a scary kind of thing if you've never edited before. But I have a whole chapter in this book devoted to showing you how to use the registry, how to back up the registry, how you can use it safely, how you can use it easily. So it's really not such a scary thing. It's
In fact, chapter 7, hack number 68, don't fear the registry.
That's right. That's exactly right. It's really surprisingly easy to use once you get used to it. First, it can be a little intimidating. It's organized into all these things called hives, and there's keys that are about half a mile long. But
I love how you have to enable something or disable it, you just change a bit.
That's right.
A 1 to a 0 or a 0 to a 1.
That's right. Often that's all you're doing, changing 1 to 0. Sometimes you're putting a path in or directory path, something like that. It's really not that hard to do. Like I said, as long as you back it up and know what you're doing, get a little bit of advice, you're going to be fine doing it. And a lot of the hacks need very simple registry hacks.
We're talking with Preston Gralla, freelance journalist and author of Windows XP Hacks, 100 Industrial Strength Tips and Tools for Windows XP. Speaking of Windows XP, Microsoft finally, and we say finally because we've been talking about it for months, released Service Pack 2.
Yes, it is finally here. I have been beta testing it from the beginning for months and months and months and living with it, and I've installed the real thing, and the real thing looks very much like the last beta. So far, I haven't really detected any differences, except one odd thing I noticed. I mean, if people haven't heard of SP2, if you don't know what it's about, it does a lot of things. Mainly what it does is does some good security stuff. There's an excellent pop-up blocker in there for Internet Explorer, something that's sorely needed. I think one of the best pop-up blockers I've seen. I think it does a really nice job. There's a good download blocker so that it stops you. It forces you to actively say, yes, I want to download this. Now, most people might think, well, I'm smart. I don't need to be prompted for that. But the truth is, a lot of spyware gets put on your system by what people call drive-by downloads. So this version of XP stops drive-by downloads.
The basic idea is that it'll download the file, it saves it automatically, everything, to some location, and then later on you might open it up and run it.
Yeah, although here what it does, now under SP2, in fact what it does is it doesn't download it. You have to say, yes, I want to download it.
Okay, with this new service pack, right.
Right.
So it makes it safer.
Right, exactly. Makes it safe. There's a lot of other ways it makes it safer. Now, one thing it does also, it turns on the Windows firewall. It used to be called the Internet Connection Firewall. Now, there's been a lot of hoopla around this for reasons I don't understand, because the truth is the Windows firewall on SP2 is the same Windows firewall that used to be called the Internet Connection Firewall, and it really is no better. There's a nicer interface to it, turning it on and using it. And it's supposed to be turned on by default in SP2, although I installed the final of SP2, and I was surprised because it wasn't turned on by default.
But then again, you might have turned it on and turned it off again, and the system might have known that at some point you'd turned it on and turned it off, and therefore you're someone using it.
That's true, although before I installed the newest of SP2, I made sure it was turned on. So who knows? I mean,
interesting.
I'll be interested in hearing if anybody else has installed it, if they have the same problem. But the issue really here is that it's still a really bad firewall. I mean, you know, Microsoft really didn't do anything to it except make it look nicer. And as I write in my book, in fact, about a much better firewall, Zone Alarm, and I recommend anybody worried about security, definitely install Zone Alarm. There's a free version. The free version is great. Install it, and it's much, much better than the firewall P2 or regular Windows.
So it's kind of a disappointment, finally, to see what their firewall is, and the free ones are much better.
Yeah, they didn't do anything.
All right.
I was surprised.
What about patch? I mean, there's been security vulnerabilities. I guess the Windows IE one, the download automatically one. Is there anything else of that kind of nature that it really fixes, and you just have to have the service pack to be safe?
You know, there's a lot of stuff kind of under the hood, a lot of plumbing stuff that, frankly, I'm not a programmer, so I can't quite get into the details here, but I know that there is sort of some plumbing stuff, too, underneath the hood, things nothing to do with what you actually see when you're using it that makes it safer as well. So there's that. There's the pop-up locker, which is really big. There's the stopping automatic downloads. There's turning Windows Firewall on by default. There's also a nice little thing that one of the most annoying pieces of spam of all time is Windows Messenger spam. Now, this is not the instant messenger I'm talking about. This is a little text-based application that's turned on by default in Windows. And if anybody's been on a corporate network and you get a little message that pops up that says, print server going to come down in 5 minutes, something like that, that's Windows Messenger. It was designed so that if you're on a network, the network administrator can send out messages to everybody. For example, you're on a network, you print something, you get a message back that's saying print job finished or something. That's
right.
Windows Messenger.
Right.
Well, unfortunately, the spammers discovered Windows Messenger a few years ago, and they have been able to use it to absolutely flood the Internet with spam. So even when you're not using a web browser, you could be using Excel. If you're connected to the Internet, you can get a piece of text spam that pops up, and there appears to be no way to turn it off. Now, I show in my book how to turn it off, but with SP2, by default, that is turned off now.
Nice,
It's a Windows service that runs behind the scenes.
We've actually addressed that service before and how to turn it off in previous shows, so we won't go into it. But it is covered in your book completely. And, of course, the book is Windows XP Hacks by O'Reilly. Now, Preston, with the service pack, I also heard that it has better Wi-Fi support. Are you familiar with the kind of Wi-Fi choosing of the network access?
Oh yeah, very much so. I have a Wi-Fi network at home. I have one for quite a while. I connect to a lot of hotspots. It's basically a much nicer, cleaner, simpler interface.
Mm-hmm.
Underneath, nothing has changed. I mean, the basic technology is still the same. But what Microsoft has changed is the way that you connect to networks, and also it has changed the way that it looks, and it's just a much more logical flow. It's prettier looking, it's easier looking, it's more consumer-oriented, it's much more logical. There's some good automatic connections in there. It's really much nicer and simpler.
Yeah, Preston, I noticed before Service Pack 2, I would get bumped off my wireless network if it found another one.
Yes.
It used to be so frustrating.
Well, you know, I don't believe Service Pack 2 is going to fix that. I'm actually working on a book now for O'Reilly, just finishing it up, called Internet Annoyances. And that is one of my main Internet annoyances, too. Like I said, I use a lot of hotspots. In my neighborhood where I live in Cambridge, there's a lot of hotspots. So if you go into a cafe or something, there could be four competing. And what happens is the way zero wireless configuration is set up, what happens is if the hotspot you're connected to, if that gets weaker and then another one gets stronger, it kind of stutters, and what happens is you get kicked off your hotspot and it tries to connect you to another hotspot.
Right.
So that's what's going on there. And I show you, I don't want to go into the details of how to do it, but basically there is a way to go into your configuration and change that. Basically what you do is you say, don't do this. You know, don't kick me off one
now
and find another.
Is that a registry edit again? To do that?
I believe, I'm trying to remember,
right.
I think it's it's either a registry edited or a simple, really hidden, you know, menu that's buried so deep you have to spend about 5 years to get there.
And that information is in your upcoming book?
Yes, Internet Annoyances.
Internet Annoyances.
Yeah,
if you want to,
that's one of the things. SP2 is not going to take care of that, though.
Yeah.
That's a shame.
Preston Gorilla is a freelance journalist and author of Windows XP Hacks by O'Reilly and some other books and the book coming out and so on and so on. And if you want to learn more about Preston, the best way to do that is go to geekspeak.org. And while you're there, you're welcome to send us a message. You're listening to GeekSpeak. My name is Lyle Troxell. And the geeks this morning are Miles Elam, John Tracy, and Sean Cleveland. And we're talking with Preston Gorilla, author and expert on Windows. Preston, you're also a blogger.
Yes.
Can you tell us quickly what a blogger is?
A blogger is, it's sort of short for weblog, and essentially it's one of these terms that is kind of like very amorphous because it could mean many things. But basically, it's somebody who writes online about something, and it's often in diary format, or it also can be in column format, and the idea is that it's supposed to be your personal opinion. Some blogs really are like, I woke up this morning and I had coffee, it was really good. Other blogs are political, and my blog is about technology.
Imagine that.
Yes.
And your blog URL is?
Well, it's go to windowsdevcenter.com. That's also an O'Reilly site. And it's right there, right sort of front and center. You can't miss it.
And there's links to it from geekspeak.org right now. All right. Let's do some more hacks because they're kind of fun. Can you tell me about halting startup programs and services? This is hack number four.
Yeah. People don't realize it, but that when you start your computer, all kinds of things are starting without you realizing it. And there's a lot of different things that they can be. Sometimes they are Windows services. Services are things that happen invisibly behind the scenes that Windows needs to do in order for you to use the operating system. But in fact, you don't need all of them, and that really slows down what you're doing. I'll give you a perfect example. Let's say you have a desktop computer. Let's say you connect to an Ethernet so you don't have wireless.
Mm-hmm.
Well, with XP, zero wireless configuration, which is a way that allows you to automatically connect to Wi-Fi networks, is turned on by default. Now, you're never going to use zero wireless configuration.
You have no wireless card.
You have no wireless card, and you're not near a wireless network, and yet the thing starts up every time. So that's a service that you don't need to start up. So there's a lot of other services like that as well that you don't realize, and it makes it slower to start up. But what it also does is it takes up your memory, so it's going to make your system to run slower. So that's one kind of thing. And I show you in the book how to find out what's running and then how to disable them pretty easily. But a lot of programs also automatically run at startup. You may or may not know that they're running at startup because sometimes they'll show you an icon to say they're running. Sometimes they won't. There's some terrible ones out there like Real Player. It's getting rid of that thing. That installs itself.
Oh, my God.
Never tells you. There are ways to hunt them down. So I show you, by the way, the worst of this, there's no central place to find this stuff. So you have to go through, there's a very nice configuration utility called msconfig that lets you see things that are at startup. There were also startup folders. You have to look there. There's also in the registry you have to look. So
but when you start looking around for these things and you find things that are starting up and you don't know what they are and you stop them, they could be something that's important for it to be running, like... Right?
Yes. You know, what I recommend doing is I go to Google all the time. And
Google's a search engine? No, I'm sorry. I'm just kidding.
Yeah, you're right. You've heard of it, I think.
Like most people. It's actually going IPO today.
Is it today?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, even despite the Playboy interview, huh?
I guess so.
Yeah. Google and Playboy interview, I never would have thought of mentioning them in the same.
Finally, us geeks have a reason to buy a Playboy magazine.
Yeah. Right, yeah.
Right.
I used to be editor of PC. And we used to joke that the latest and greatest CPU close-up was the equivalent of our Playboy centerfold.
Yeah.
You know. But anyway, where were we? We were here. Oh, yes, finding programs that run at startup. I always go to Google. I type in the file name, the executable file name. And you're going to find exactly what that is. So I'd recommend doing that.
How do you find the file name, though?
It should show it to you.
What
you can do, actually, is... It usually will, for example, if you go into msconfig,
mm-hmm.
and where I show you to go to
and
in there.
Let's do clarity on how to run msconfig. Sean?
Okay. Go to the command line, or go to the run.
The start menu, and click on run.
And then open type msconfig.
msconfig, okay, all one word.
Yep, one word, and it'll pop up there. It's called the system configuration utility. There's a whole bunch of tabs there. And over on the right-hand side, there's a tab called startup. And if you click on the startup tab, it's going to show you a lot of programs that are running on startup without you even knowing it. Now, for most of these programs, if you look in the center there, what you, the center column, mm-hmm. under command, it's going to show you the full path and the executable file name.
Okay.
Like I'm looking at mine right now, and there's all kinds of it in there.
So then you just look at that file name and go into Google and put that in, and there'll be comments about, like, this is good, this is bad, this is necessary, things of that
right.
nature.
Uh-huh. And usually what it'll do is it'll usually tell you what it does, you know, why you would want to run it, why you wouldn't run it. There's quite a bit of information about that. So before shutting anything down, if you don't know what it is, go into Google. Now, not only that, in msconfig, in fact, you can look in the if you look in the directory, that's going to give you a hint. Sometimes in msconfig, in the startup tab there, it's even going to tell you what it is.
Yeah.
But even if it doesn't tell you what it is, if you look at the command itself, if you look at the directory, that's going to give you a pretty good hint about what program is running it, and then the file name sometimes will help.
If it's in a QuickTime directory or an Adobe directory,
right, exactly.
Yeah, you're going to know that it has to do with that application.
Right.
You're listening to Geek Speak. This program is supported by a grant from Cruise.io, providing internet services, including DSL, spam filters, PHP, MySQL, now with nationwide access. Information about Cruise.io membership is available online at cruiseio.com or by calling 459-6301. This week on This American Life, what it's like going from working as a bureaucrat, translating boring government documents, to being the interpreter, confidant, and man Friday to 22-year-old Chinese basketball sensation Yao Ming. Lost in Translation, This American Life, Sunday at 10 a.m. right here on KUSP After Car Talk. You're listening to Geek Speak on KUSP. If you have questions or comments, the phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. You can, of course, go to geekspeak.org using your favorite browser. Click on The Geeks, and then click on Send a Message. And we'll get that message in our email and respond on air, unless time doesn't permit, which will respond to you personally. That's the service you get from KUSP and GeekSpeak. This program is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. The phone numbers to call in now, 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. We're talking about Windows XP, hacks and tips and tricks, and likely we have a genius or expert on, Preston Gorala, a freelance journalist and author of Windows XP Hacks by O'Reilly. Pretty versed in the subject. Call up with your Windows questions, and we'll get to them.
We got an email, actually, from somebody who tried the msconfig trick in Windows 2000.
Okay.
So,
did it work?
Preston, are you there?
Yeah, Preston?
Did they say if it worked or not?
No, it did not work.
And what did they say? What went wrong? Did it just not run?
Got an error message.
What's the error message?
Probably that it doesn't exist.
No. Oh, it doesn't exist. You see, I don't use 2000 and never have. I stayed with the computer.
No, I know Windows 2000, you can use IP config for your TCP IP settings, but I don't think it has the equivalent.
I don't think so either. Upgrade or, you know, go do a Google search and just search for XP config 2000, yeah. Windows 2000. Yeah. You might find an equivalent application that does the same kind of thing.
Yeah, that's what I would suggest, too. I didn't realize that it wasn't in Windows 2000. That's too bad. It's a useful utility.
Yeah. Well, of course, we're talking about Windows XP, not 2000. They are different. Let's talk a little bit about how different they are. 2000 was kind of built on NT, correct?
Yes. What happened is Microsoft, before XP, for years and years, Microsoft essentially had two versions of Windows. It had what it considered the consumer version of Windows, which was Windows 3.1, Windows 95, Windows 98, Windows ME, all that. And then it had, in parallel with that, it had Windows NT and then Windows 2000. Windows NT and 2000 were supposedly for corporations. They were much more security-oriented than the consumer level. There were problems with NT and 2000 running games and things like that. For years and years and years, Microsoft kept saying they were going to combine the two lines, and they somehow never got around to it. And actually, in XP, they finally did. So XP really was a major rewrite of Windows, really pretty much from the ground up. For the consumer version, it pretty much finally did away with the underlying DOS support. I mean, you could still run DOS, but it wasn't really built on it anymore. So what it did is it took the security and stability of the NT 2000 line, added to it the kind of consumer interface of the consumer Windows line, and finally there's a unified operating system.
So it is really fundamentally different than the other operating systems.
Yes, it absolutely is. And I have to say it is a dramatic improvement over previous, especially consumer versions of Windows. The stability, I mean, when I used to run Windows, it used to be I'd figure on rebooting 4 or 5 times a day.
Mm-hmm.
And the stability in XP is really quite exceptional, because if an application does crash, that application is in its own window, and it's not going to, sometimes it might, but generally it's not going to affect the rest of XP. Much, much more stable operating system than the previous version of Windows.
You're listening to Geek Speak. We're talking with Preston Gralla, author of Windows XP Hacks. Richard from Monterey, welcome to Geek Speak.
Yes, hello.
Yes, Richard, we can hear you clearly.
Good. My question, I was just listening, and you were talking about MSConfig and taking things off the startup function.
Yeah.
And I've done that. It works nicely. But one of my questions is, I'm afraid to take some things off because I don't know if I'll be able to access them in the future.
Can you give us an example?
Save your icon someplace and get back to it?
Well, I think I know what you're saying. I think I can answer that. Yeah, when you go into MSConfig and you remove that, you know, you uncheck the way to say things don't run it is you uncheck it. All you're really doing there, you're not deleting anything at all. All you're saying is don't run this. So it actually will stay there. You're not deleting a file. And in fact, what will happen is that line will still stay in the startup in MSConfig. There just won't be a check next to it. So what you can do, go back, run MSConfig, go to the startup tab, go back to that line, and just put a checkbox next to it.
And then restart your machine.
Restart your
machine.
Okay.
Now, question specifically what's happened is, for example, we had one of the antivirus programs, and we didn't like it. So we removed the program, but it still kept coming up in the startup. We had to go back to the startup menu, back through MSConfig, actually uncheck it so that it wouldn't go through. You know, wouldn't have icons saying, oh, well, this one won't work because whatever. So I assume just because you remove a program through add or remove programs, you still have to go back through the startup and find it.
Well, yeah, it sounds like, boy, that's a pretty bad piece of software that if whoever wrote it, that they left behind a DLL or an EXE or whatever it was they left behind. That's pretty bad. I mean, a program, once you uninstall a program, it really should. It doesn't, but it really should remove all traces of itself, including any executable.
Well, it's a pretty popular program. It's quite a bit.
Excuse me?
But we changed because we had heard it wasn't a very good program.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Really, that's a bad sign.
But you did the right thing going after it in startup.
Okay.
You know,
all right, that's
way,
my question. Thanks.
Thank you very much for the call.
Yeah, you know, one thing also, this brings up a good point. The registry is something that Windows uses basically for everything it does. It's the instructions for how to run the operating system. When you uninstall programs, they don't always do a really good job. They might leave behind registry entries that can really clog up your system and slow it down. There's a really nice tool called Registry First Aid, which is a piece of shareware. And you run that, and what it does is it looks through your registry, finds problems with it, and fixes them for you. So that's another consideration, thing to do if you're having problems with uninstalled programs.
Great. Good suggestion. We're going to keep on going to calls because, hey, people are calling. We want to talk to them. So, Umar from Paso Robles, welcome. Can you turn your radio down, please?
Hi, how you doing?
Quite well, thank you. What's your question?
Yeah, the question is this. He was talking about the MSConfig. What's the difference between the MSConfig and the going into the task manager and then going into the processes tab and turning things off there? What's the difference between those two? Because those are all things that are running in memory, correct?
Right, they're all running in memory. Now, when you go into...
You know, Umar?
Yes?
Please turn your radio down all the way.
I did, sorry.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah. When you go into Task Manager and you look at the processes and you close a process down, what you're doing is you're closing down a process that has already been running. Now, that process could have been kicked off at startup. It could have been kicked off by a program that you manually ran after startup. So it wasn't necessarily at startup, but it's something that's running on your computer right now. And what you're doing is you're going in there and you're saying, shut this thing down right this second. When you go into MSConfig, the startup tab, what you're doing is you're saying, next time I run my computer, don't start this program. So in other words, what should happen is when you go into MSConfig and you say don't start the program, the next time you run your computer, when you go into the task manager and you look at the processes, that process won't be running next time around. So use the task manager to shut down processes or programs that are currently running. Use msconfig to shut down programs that will run the next time you start up XP.
I see.
Okay, that makes sense.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for the call. We're going to go ahead and go to Christina. So, Cal, Christina, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi.
Hi.
Hey, thanks very much for last time for helping me. Anyways, I've been using msconfig. I have a bunch of kids in college, so I have a 98, and then my kids have 2000. I have an XP computer that I use.
A mishmash, huh?
So I've used everything, and, you know, being that my kids are all over, we're always getting all sorts of problems. So I've gotten way better at dealing with all this than I ever wanted to be. So I've used msconfig in the older computers quite well to find out if something got aboard my computer and wormed its way into the startup, like bots like Jupyter or something like that, because they show up in the startup, and then I know what to look for. So I've downloaded all these things to try to get these worms off the computer, and some of them end up in the registry like DSO exploit. And I've had that.
Preston, do you have some suggestions?
Yeah, I do. You know, a really good tool for one of the problems is with all the worms that are out there, and when you're using the internet with all the sort of drive-by downloads and all the spyware, it's pretty tough to keep your computer clean. And antivirus software is not very good at that.
It isn't. And I ended up downloading SpyBot Search and Destroy and T-Timer.
Adware is good, SpyBot for Search and Destroy, but I'll tell you what I think is the best.
What is the best?
It's called WebRoot Spy Sweeper.
WebRoot?
WebRoot Spy Sweeper. And what I like about WebRoot Spy Sweeper is the other programs, what they do is, after the fact, they try to fix the problem.
Mm-hmm.
WebRoot, what you can do is you can set it so that it constantly monitors your system. And
mm-hmm.
any time there's any kind of change, like a program that wants to run a startup, it says, this program wants to run a startup. Do you want to let it do it or not? So you're alerted every time there's any system change that could be a piece of spyware. It pops up and says, it's trying to change your system. And it allows you, therefore, to stop the change. So
T-Timer does that, too, and it does it really well.
What were you saying?
T-Timer.
Oh, I don't know that one.
T-Timer is a part of Geeks.com, and it's a little add-on to Spy Blaster.
Uh-huh.
And it basically tells you whenever any change is made to the registry, and you either okay it or deny it.
Yeah, this is not just the registry. This is anything. This is, you know, a lot of there's a lot of spyware out there that are homepage hijackers where they change your homepage. So if it tries to change your homepage, it'll tell you. If it does registry stuff, if it tries to run a program at startup.
And again, Preston, this application that you're referring to is
called WebRoot Spy Sweeper.
Webroot.com.
Webroot.com. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Can I ask one more thing?
Please do.
That a lot of us are wondering about is, okay, why am I getting so much script in my cookies?
So much what?
Script in my cookies.
So
should
script.
There be all these script files in my cookies?
She's asking about script.
When I sweep my cookies and I check out my cookies, which I do on a regular basis just to make sure that, you know, because, you know, I've had a lot of problems, and my kids all have had a lot of problems, with, especially with XP going online because it gets so much crap.
Mm-hmm.
And, in fact, I can't even use XP for email right now because it just...
Okay, so you get a whole bunch of cookies set, and you go into the cookies folder, and you're seeing, what are you seeing in there?
Well, I see all these separate folders that don't get cleaned up by Windows Cleanup, and they're full of script. And they usually have names with all sorts of numbers and letters in them.
Do you know the extension of the name of it? Is it .script?
Yeah.
Hmm.
And I'm wondering if that is normal, or is that an indication that...
Thanks for the question. We'll ask Preston. I'm going to go ahead and say goodbye to you so we can hear Preston a little better.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you very much.
I don't know that one. I haven't seen that, so that's something I'm going to have to look into. And it sounds like that might be visiting some sites whose cookies are running scripts, and scripts can certainly, like JavaScript, can certainly do damage and can be malicious scripts.
But that's the wrong cache location for holding scripts. It shouldn't be there.
From a technical standpoint, I can't think of a single reason why you put a script in a cookie.
It makes sense to me that the dot script is something, some application that she has that cleans up cookies or checks cookies or something. And so there's some folders being generated by another application in that location having to do with cookies. That's my only guess.
It could be.
Could be a worm that did those. But there's no problem with deleting
the software there. Yeah.
Just shut down your browser and delete everything inside cookies. That shouldn't do anything bad to your browser.
Right.
Preston, I know you've got to leave in about 5 minutes for another interview, and I just want to ask you a couple more questions about your book. And
especially
stuff.
Like Service Pack 2. How do you feel about it?
Yeah, what's your overall feeling?
I would recommend that people install it in 30 days. I would not install it right away on a computer that you really need to be using. So if you have a bunch of different computers and use one for beta or for testing things out, install it on that. But I wouldn't install it on a main computer now, not because I found any problems with it, because in fact I haven't found problems with it, but just as a general rule, frequently with a big, gigantic change like this, Microsoft usually doesn't get it right the first time around, and it usually takes a month or so for all the bug reports and things like that to trickle in and for it to either do fixes or for it to publish workarounds. So I would say in about 30 days, I would absolutely download it because I think that it is a great improvement. And
now, will Microsoft, will they make changes to the actual Service Pack 2 itself after they've released it?
I don't know. Yeah. I mean, certainly if they find anything major, they'll have to.
Right. Yeah. Okay. And there's nothing, you don't think there's anything pressing enough that you'd need to do it before those 30 days?
No, I don't think so. I mean, the pop-up blocker is great. The extra security is great. To face it, you've been living with XP the way it is for years already. So
right.
Another 30 days is not going to make a difference. And, you know, most likely if you download it today and install it, you're not going to notice a problem. But just for security, safety's sake, I'd recommend waiting 30 days.
Are you still working on your book, XP Power User?
That's about to be published. Mm-hmm. I'm actually looking at the edited pages, and it should be published, I believe, in October.
Now, is this kind of just like a more in-depth version of the Windows XP hacks?
Well, actually, it's a little less in-depth. There's a lot more. In Windows XP hacks, there are 100 of them, and each of them are relatively in-depth. And the whole point of each of the hacks is not only to show you how to accomplish something, but how to learn what's going on so you can sort of hack yourself.
Right.
Power User is slightly different. With Power User, there's more like about 400 rather than 100 tips and hints. Each one is a little less detailed, so it's a little less in-depth, but each of them is targeted at a much more specific purpose.
Thank you, Preston, very much. Preston Grubb is the author of more than 30 books, which have been translated into nearly 20 languages, including Windows XP Hacks, which we've been talking about, his upcoming book, Windows XP Power User, and a book that will be coming out even further ahead, Internet Annoyances. He's also a freelance journalist, columnist, and web editor. He's written for major national newspapers and magazines, including PC Magazine, Computer World, the Los Angeles Times, the Dallas Morning News, and so on and so on and so on. And, Preston, thank you very much for being on GeekSpeak today.
Well, thanks for having me. It was great.
Bye-bye. Preston Grill, you can learn more about him at geekspeak.org. Just click on today's show. Of course, also at GeekSpeak, you can go and click on The Geeks and click on Send a Message and get a message in our email box that we'll answer on air, geekspeak.org. And if you're next to a phone, 476-2800, toll free at 1-800-655-5877. We're taking your calls, even though our guest moved on. But let's do a little news while we're waiting for those calls. Sean? Miles, hi. You're typing away. I'm hearing you click, click, click. How you doing?
Hi. In Microsoft News, we'll just continue with that.
Makes sense.
Microsoft has actually changed a longstanding policy with regards to Internet Explorer. They had been saying for, I think, a year or so now, year and a half, that they weren't going to release a Internet Explorer 7.0 as a standalone product. They were only going to release a new version of the browser as part of Longhorn.
Which is the operating system that will come out in 2008.
Next version of Windows. However, they have now reneged on that and said, yes, we're going to release an Internet Explorer 7 before Longhorn is released.
Hmm.
And most people have attributed this to a number of factors, one of them being security issues with the existing Internet Explorer, but also feature disparities between Internet Explorer and many of the other browsers that are starting to come up. Internet Explorer is starting to see some market erosion. So just leaving it, there's no browser improvements for the next 2 years or however long it takes for Longhorn to get out, they're going to see some major fallbacks on the browsers that are supported, or the Internet Explorer browser usage. So basically, in response to that, they were looking at doing things like improving CSS support, improving PNG support, tabbed browsing was a big one.
Okay, so basically they're going to beef their browser up kind of ahead of schedule. Why do you think, Miles, that they're doing that, they're changed that tune? Is it because Longhorn's been so delayed, or what's your feeling on it?
Well, I think it is because of the other browsers that are out there, like Firefox, like Opera, like
ones that are doing good things, and they're better browsers right now.
Right, because Internet Explorer 6 came out, what was it, a year or 2 years ago?
Yeah, something like that.
And so, yeah, 2 years ago, I think, is actually.
I mean, one thing, if they release 7... I feel like I want to threaten Microsoft, you know,
a lot of people
or challenge
have,
them. Release it with good CSS support, CSS2 support, and please transparent PNGs, please alpha transparencies.
Yeah, for the audience out there, CSS and CSS2 are cascading style sheets. It's a way of doing the equivalent of print publishing on the web, allowing you to set borders and specify fonts and how big it is and how wide certain margins are, and setting background images.
It's basically a way of formatting HTML documents with style that's not kind of a hack, but actually a good design.
And it covers it for an entire site. So if you want to make changes to the way your entire site looks and all its encompassed pages, you can just change the style sheet, and it makes changes universally.
In fact, if you are using Mozilla or Firefox or a few other browsers that do this, you can go to geekspeak.org. And, Miles, what's the menu item for changing the style sheet? How do you change the style sheet in the menu item for Mozilla?
Well, it depends upon which version of Mozilla you have.
Let's say the most recent, like Firefox, let's say. Firefox
Does it differently than Mozilla. Mozilla, okay. It has a menu item, but I don't know off the top of my head. Firefox has an icon in the bottom left-hand corner.
Yeah, it looks like a little little canvas or a little what is that? Palette and a paintbrush.
Right, but
so you click on that, and it
only appears if you have alternate style sheets.
Right, so if you go to geekspeak.org with Firefox, and down the bottom left little symbol, click on that, and you'll see different versions of our style sheet for the site, and you can actually pick the different ones, and it will change the look of the page.
Yeah, not cool. Too drastic a change. They're actually pretty simple.
Pretty simple. In fact, the homepage is the only thing you actually see the difference.
Another thing that CSS allows you to do, and something that geekspeak.org does, is when you print a document, normally you have all of the navigation, all of the items on there. Links are simply blue underlines, and on a printed page, it's not useful. So with a print style sheet, just the user doesn't have to do anything. By using these, you're able to have a page that strips out the navigation, for example, changes those URLs to be the names of the links followed by a printing of what the URL is in print, you know, something that's more useful for the printed form. These are things that you can get through CSS and better CSS support, although I do have to say that Internet Explorer already supports that.
Yeah, a lot of that. So we look forward to Internet Explorer 7 when it comes out, and I'm glad Microsoft's doing this before Longhorn. Don from Corleus, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call.
Pleasure.
I have a eMachine T1600, I think it's called, and I had a crash on it, and replaced the motherboard. And when I booted up with the new motherboard, I had the restore disk in there. I went through the...
Wait, who's restore disk? eMachine's?
The one that came with the machine.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, which probably was my problem, because I went through the initializing of the hard drive and went through the process just fine, took both of the CDs, and at the end, it gave me the normal message saying initialization was successful, stored this disk in the same place and reboot. So I took the disk out, and when I tried to reboot, I came back to that first window where you get the safe mode or the safe mode with network.
Right. You know what's happening? Don, eMachines are kind of inherently don't touch them inside. In fact, the kind of definition of an eMachine is a machine that you don't open up and extend and make better. Would the geeks in the room recommend say the same thing? So replacing a motherboard on an eMachine is like, yeah, it won't be a problem, really. If you put a new motherboard in, all your peripherals work, it won't be a problem, except that operating system that was for the eMachine is for the eMachine. They do weird things with their installations.
And they tend to buy the
Isn't XP no matter where it is?
No, not really.
It's loading in drivers specific for the parts that eMachine buys, and they tend to buy the cheapest stuff out there.
They're going to remove
the cost of the machine down.
I mean, that installation of Windows XP is, and Miles, I mean, Sean, I want you to confirm this. eMachine's Windows, or startup disks that are Windows XP, could be a modified version of Windows.
Definitely could be a modified version of Windows.
Because of certain driver things that they need to do.
Right.
I mean,
and when Microsoft encourages OEMs to build
different versions.
Yeah. Modified versions based on the machines.
I have a disk which came with the motherboard, but that doesn't seem to do
that. That won't have your operating system on it. Right. Basically, what's going to happen on any OEM version of the operating system, they might make a disk with the operating system on and other applications. Let's say you get a version that has some applications that don't come with Windows. An OEM can add those in. So one thing eMachine might do is go, okay, we're looking around for modems. Wow, here's 10,000 modems that have an error that they don't work with Windows XP by default. Well, how can we fix that? Because we're going to get these modems at dirt cheap prices because no one can use them. So they do some hacking, they get the modems real cheap, and they find a little hack, and boom, it's edited, and it works. But that disk that comes with it's that edited weird version for those modems. And there's the problem. So basically, get another disk of get Windows XP Professional. I'd recommend, but it's a little more expensive. And install it on your machine, you'll probably be okay.
Do you think I'm going to have to pay for this other version of it?
Oh yeah.
So Microsoft or whatever the manufacturer of the computer won't be able to solve this problem for
me. No, you crack the case on eMachine, they won't support you at all.
Okay.
You don't have to do a Windows.
Yeah, I could run Linux on it.
You can run Linux; it's free.
Yeah. Or Windows.
If I can get it to boot up with Linux, is there a way that after it boots up with Linux, I can partition it and get Windows on it without having to pay for the professional?
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, not without paying for the professional, no.
I would still have to install the professional.
Well, you could get a basic version of Windows XP, but you might be able to get that version of the E thing to run. It's just going to be some hacking and some weird things.
You can check eBay, too.
As a general note, if you're putting both operating systems on, you put Windows XP on first, and then put Linux on after.
Oh, but in this case, I can't do that because I can't get XP on, but I could get Linux on.
You know, but getting Linux on isn't really going to solve all your problems because, I mean, do you use Office? If you use Office,
OpenOffice actually has gotten a lot better.
I mean, it's possible that you could just go, okay, you know what? I'm having trouble with XP. I can't get it to work. I don't want to pay for it. Let's just switch over to Linux and start doing Linux. And, yeah, pretty much you can do everything you can do on Linux. You can do, you know, Windows. It can work. You get OpenOffice, which is a free Office version, which opens Office documents. But it's a migration. It's a big change in your programming lifestyle.
Yeah, that's okay.
Computing lifestyle. So there's our thoughts on it.
All right.
Good
Thank
luck.
Thank you very much.
You bet.
Bye-bye.
Of course, other people can call in 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Sean, more news?
Yeah, actually, this is about Service Pack 2. Service Pack 2 does have a cool feature that Microsoft has included. It supports a hardware feature. It's called Data Execution Protection, and it's kind of interesting. This week has been quite a headline news week as far as what this is doing to Intel, because none of the Intel processors support this feature. What it happens is a lot of viruses and worms are spread by buffer overflows. So a program says, I have a bunch of data, and it needs to be written to a particular, you know, memory region. And the virus is attached to that application says, oh, yeah, we're going to write more data.
Uh-huh.
And that data that spills over, the computer says, oh, this is executable code, and runs it, not knowing that that's a virus.
It's a simple bit version.
So it's like a back way into a computer, and this is how a lot of them are spread. Sasser, a big one.
And if the program is designed better, it will protect itself from having buffer overflows existing.
Well, that's the problem. It really has... It has more to do with the processor. So it's a hardware capability that needs to be built into the processor. It doesn't matter if the software supports it or not.
Actually, software...
So Linux has had the support for a long time, but if the processor doesn't have the capability to turn the bit and say, no, don't run this type of code, then it's not going to matter. So what's happening this week is Microsoft released Data Execution Protection in Service Pack 2, but unless you have a processor that supports it, and currently only the Athlon 64 from AMD does, then you can't take advantage of that. So it's a big security feature. But and ZDNet, very kind of controversial here, they came out with an article that says, critical XP Service Pack 2 alert, cancel all non-AMD system buys. So now Intel is up in arms.
Why?
Because Intel wasn't going to have this feature until next year.
Right.
Now it's on the fast track.
Okay.
They're backpedaling.
Yeah, as far as the software can block... buffer overflows. There's no reason why a software developer couldn't. That's one of the big things about security.
And good design and software.
Right. The problem is that software developers haven't. And in defense of software developers, it's kind of like taking an algebra test and never getting it wrong, never getting anything wrong, and showing all your steps. So what hardware developers have done is tried to patch up the holes that software developers have made.
Right. So the operating system could take advantage of this feature.
Which makes a lot of sense because, as you said, there's so many so many exploits caused by a software that's written poorly, well, has a bug in it that allows for buffer overrun, and then you just handle it from the operating system and processor level, and then any application you run can't do an overflow. Kind of the operating system with the processor protects it. Right. Which makes a lot of sense. It sounds like a smarter computer. Intel doesn't have it. AMD has it.
But only with their 64-bit processor. Oh, and their Sempron, which is, I think it's a low-end version of the Athlon 64 for mobile and low-end desktop.
So out of the four geeks in the room here, only one person really actually has this bit thing.
I have it on my system at home, yeah.
So we should try it. We'll see if we can do a buffer overflow.
Actually, last night I was playing around with it, and there's this NX test piece of software that does just that. Does the buffer overflow and emulates a virus, and it caught it just fine. It was really cool.
Right, but, you know, we should probably test that. So if anyone wants to donate to us, Athlon 64s,
we're accepting.
That's okay.
We're accepting hardware right now.
Well, and we should have at least a good P4 to test it against.
Yeah, that's true. We should. Yeah, that's true. Please, John, news.
In other big news, Google today is doing their big IPO, which is uniquely... They're doing it in the Google way, which is to have a big controversy around it. I don't think that's what they intended, but that's how it's happened. They gave an interview to Playboy magazine. They actually had the interview before they started filing for their IPO back in April. Oh, am I sent? Oh, hey. Hi.
Hey,
is this thing on? Section 5 of the Securities Act of 1933, which is one of the guiding lines of IPOs, says you cannot have a media interview. And they did do this interview before they started filing, but then the interview came out during the time of filing.
Right, so, which is smart for Playboy because, of course, now it hits the news and Playboy sells more.
Exactly. Google said if the interview is found to violate security laws, it could be forced to repurchase all the shares that are being sold today. Right? Today, right now, the Dutch auction for the shares is happening. So, theoretically, all the money that Google stands to make today selling these shares, they might have to rebuy if they are found to be in violation of this law.
But they're going to still go forward. Because
they are still going forward. It's going on right now.
All right. Yeah. And they're not really in control of when another person publishes an article. I mean, a news story. I mean, it seems like they did okay. They didn't do anything wrong.
Right.
But it'll be investigated. Google is really a unique company. We should probably have somebody on from Google because they operate in a little different ways than most corporations do. We have Bob online. Oh. Hi, Bob. Welcome to GeekSpeak.
Thank you.
Bob, where are you calling from?
Well, I'm standing at a field of bell peppers west of Gilroy at the moment.
Great. Are they ripe enough to eat?
They're ripe, yeah.
Okay. Well, what's your question, Bob?
I've seen some comments on the web recently about XP having trouble or incompatibility with SCSI hardware, and I just... thought I'd run that by you for some enlightenment.
So you're seeing reports that people have a lot of trouble with SCSI hardware using Windows XP?
That's correct, yeah. Compatibility problems.
Do you know of any specific SCSI cards?
I think the reference was to Adaptec and LSI.
I haven't heard that.
You know, it makes sense to me that... do you think it's the entire SCSI line has problems with it? Or do you think there's devices that are being plugged into SCSI lines that don't work with XP? Because that is very common.
Okay.
Because what's going on is if somebody makes a scanner and the scanner has the drivers, and the drivers are released for Windows 98. And then Windows XP comes along, and that hardware manufacturer is no longer making that scanner, and they're selling new scanners. So why would they want to develop the drivers for XP for the old hardware that they're not going to sell?
I've seen that before.
So what they do is they don't make a driver for it. And all of a sudden you've got a scanner, and you upgrade to Windows XP. You can't get a driver for it. You can't use it. And that happens a lot in SCSI only because those kinds of devices like scanners and such... 5 years ago, we were all SCSI-based. Does that make sense?
That makes a lot of sense. I have a scanner that's currently working as a doorstop.
Yeah, exactly.
For that reason.
Yeah. Yeah, we all have scanners kind of laying around that are SCSI, and it's like, what do you do? It's really frustrating.
Okay.
Not just SCSI.
Well, thank you for that.
Well, thank you very much. And it could be that it's other problems as well. We'll keep it in mind.
But I personally use SCSI hard drives and CD-ROM and burners.
In XP.
In XP without a problem.
Bob, enjoy the bell peppers.
Thank you.
Thanks, Nicole. You can call in too. Well, actually, no more calls now. I think we're getting close to the end of the hour. We'll do a couple more news items, though. Miles.
Sure.
Or, you know, Sean? I don't know. Which
I just did one.
Okay,
Miles.
We'll do
it's Miles' turn.
Yeah.
There's a new type of smart glass that's been developed, and it blocks infrared heat, but only when it gets hot. So in other words, only after it reaches 29 degrees Celsius or 84.2 degrees Fahrenheit. Is there there's a thin film that's been put on this glass. When that heats up, a chemical change occurs that starts blocking infrared radiation.
Just infrared?
Just infrared heat radiation.
Wow. So basically, it's still transparent. You have no problems.
It does have a very strong yellow tinge at this point, although they were talking about changes to it, such as adding a titanium oxide to it and then to make it so it bonds better. One thing is it rubs off, but also putting other elements into to counteract the yellow.
Okay, what would you be able to use this glass for? Well, this treated glass for?
For homes. To be able to have it so that
it would reduce the cost of air conditioning substantially.
Because you're able to keep the light coming in, but it would block the heat when it's very hot out, but still allow the heat to come in during wintertime.
That is really neat.
I like it.
Great technology.
Cool. What is it? It's not coming out. Just talk about the research being done on it.
It's in development phase, yeah.
Great. Thank you very much for that, Miles.
Speaking of development, there's a group getting together, WWISE, short for Worldwide Spectrum Inefficiency. I think it means they're working in the efficiency, not like inefficiency. And they're trying to come up with a new, or they're working on coming up with a new draft for 802.11. They're going to call it 802.11n, and that should have a throughput rate of 100 megabits per second. Currently, the fastest one out there at A&G, which have 54 megabits per second, so it should be twice as fast.
Geeks, thanks for the news. Grey Wolf Computer Systems has provided a grant in support of this program. Grey Wolf Computer Systems offers custom computer systems and personalized service for repairs, upgrades, and networks in the East Cliff Village Shopping Center in Santa Cruz. The Geeks today, Miles Elam, John Tracy, and Sean Cleveland, thank you very much for being here. Our producer is Maggie Cleveland. And to those listening and calling in, thank you for making GeekSpeak what it is. Without your input at SBS, geeking out. And who wants to listen to that? This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, Santa Cruz, KBH, San Arto. On the web at KUSP.org. I'm Lyle Troxell for KUSP and for GeekSpeak. Stay tuned now for The Open Road.